The Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra is in the house with its chief conductor Vasily Petrenko, who was born in St. Petersburg 70 years after Dmitri Shostakovich, although it was still Leningrad when Petrenko was a child. If you've been following Petrenko's highly regarded recordings of the Shostakovich symphonies in Liverpool, you'll be looking forward to the second half of the prom, Shostakovich's 10th symphony, the first to appear after Stalin's death in 1953. And Petrenko was telling me earlier that he's really getting his Liverpudlians to play like Russians these days. Well, Petrenko wasn't even born the last time Frederick Delius's violin concerto was heard at the proms over 40 years ago, and it's championed this evening by one of our most committed Delians, Tasmin Little, who's really been enjoying working with Petrenko for the first time. And before Delius, there's the first London performance of a new Ninth Symphony by the master of the Queen's music, Sir Peter Maxwell Davis, which Petrenko and the orchestra premiered in Liverpool in June. It's dedicated to Her Majesty the Queen on the occasion of her Diamond Jubilee. But I'm sure I'd heard Maxwell Davis saying that he wasn't going to be writing another symphony.
I did say that, and then I wrote number 8, the Antarctic Symphony, and now I've written yet another one, number 9. And there's going to be a number 10.
And when it comes to number 9, there's a lot of historical baggage.
Which I ignore. I made number 9 a very modest one-movement work.
And is it a self-consciously royal symphony for the Jubilee?
No, I don't think it is. It has fanfares in it, but they've got a quite particular tone. They're not jingoistic celebration fanfares. There's an inwardness about them. And I didn't want to write that kind of symphony. I really don't think I could. I enjoyed writing it tremendously. It's quite powerful. But it does remind me very much of the last symphony that we have from Sibelius, number 7. I think the ghost of that work was hovering over my shoulder while I was writing this one.
Sir Peter Maxwell Davis. Well, the orchestra's leader, Thelma Handy, is there. And here to conduct Sir Peter Maxwell Davis's Symphony No. 9 is the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra's chief conductor, Vasily Petrenko.
Thank you.
You've just heard the Symphony No. 9 for Orchestra and Brass Sextet by Sir Peter Maxwell Davis, dedicated to Her Majesty the Queen in her Diamond Jubilee year, a work begun in Lazio in Italy last December, finished earlier this year at the composer's home in Orkney. And Max says that the way the brass sextet interrupts the main orchestra was inspired partly by the way Italian churches often have a central nave in one style that clashes with the side chapels in other styles, and yet there's still a strained symmetry that manages to hold it all together. The two sets of brass players being brought to their feet by Vasily Petrenko. Acknowledge their major part in the work. And here comes Sir Peter Maxwell Davis down the steps onto the stage to join the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra and its chief conductor. The second time they performed the work, the world premiere was in Liverpool in June. And Max made no secret in his programme note for the Provence performance that he's also bearing witness in this symphony to the UK's interventions in Iraq and Afghanistan. But he points out that he means no disrespect to military bands whose sound he's come to know well and to love as he's been master of the Queen's music. A much-loved figure here at the Proms. It's not always been that way. His first experience of conducting at the Prom was an accident. Sir Malcolm Sargent apparently threw up his hands in horror when confronted with a Maxwell Davis score and thrust it at the young composer, saying he couldn't possibly conduct it. So composer turned conductor, or, well, just beat time, he recalls, petrified out of his wits. Well, Sir Peter Maxwell Davis goes off stage with Vasily Petrenko. Yes, they'll be back. That London premiere of his Ninth Symphony, much appreciated here in the Royal Albert Hall. He has to be one of the most performed living composers here at the Proms. I think there have been over 50 works of his since 1962, when his John Taverner Fantasia was commissioned by the BBC. And I think, well, as of now, every Maxwell Davis symphony has been heard at the Proms. Quite a few of them conducted by the composer. They go again. Vasily Petrenko towering over Peter Maxwell Davis. Well, we won't have to wait long for a 10th symphony, but not from the composer of the Queen's music. That may yet be some way off, although you heard him tell me he's already thinking about his 10th. Dmitri Shostakovich's Symphony No. 10 is the second half of this evening's BBC Prom, but next the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic is joined by solo violinist Tasmin Little for a performance of a work for which she cares deeply, the Violin Concerto by Frederick Delius. And as I found out from Tasmin this afternoon, her connections to the Liverpool Phil go back a long way.
Yes, it was definitely one of the earliest professional concerto dates that I did, and it was the Delius, and it was for the Bradford Festival that took place in, golly, when was it? 1985, I think it was. And they were just so lovely, and yeah, thoroughly enjoyed working with them. And so I've given, I think this will be actually coming up to my 50th performance with the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic.
And your first recording of the Delius Concerto goes back 20 years now, so you've been living with it for a very long time. Are you finding new things in the work the whole time?
I certainly am. And actually, I've enjoyed working with Vasily so much because he has got a completely different take on it. And he's brought out some details in the orchestra that I haven't really encountered before. So it's been a fantastic experience. It's made me review certain aspects of the concerto. And actually, that's one of the wonderful things about working with different conductors. You know, each person brings their own particular individuality to the orchestration.
Tasmin Little talking to me earlier about how much she's been enjoying working with someone who's approaching the Delius Violin Concerto with fresh ears. And Delius was inspired to write the piece by the great British violinist Albert Sammons. There's actually a splendid photo of him in this evening's Proms programme. Sammons in army uniform playing his violin on top of a tank in Trafalgar Square in, well, they think in 1916, the year Delius finished this concerto. Tasmin certainly hadn't seen the photo before. She much enjoyed getting the opportunity. Well, here she comes, Tasmin Little, with conductor Vasily Petrenko to perform the violin concerto by Frederick Delius, finished in wartime England after Delius and his wife had left northern France in the wake of the German invasion.
Thank you.
sunset hues and a shimmer of strings, ending the Violin Concerto from 1916 by Frederick Delius, which you've just heard performed live here at the BBC Proms by one of the works and the composer's most ardent champions, Tasmin Little, with the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by Vasily Petrenko. The first time Tasmin and Vasily have worked together, but she has a long relationship with the Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra, as she was telling us, going back to her first professional appearance with them in May 1985 in this very concerto in Bradford, Delius's Yorkshire birthplace. Back they come onto the platform. Tasmin, well, she's shimmering, really. She's wearing a reddish-gold sleeveless dress with a bronze-coloured demi-train or fishtail. We couldn't decide what to call it when she was describing it earlier, so take your pick. Petrenko bringing the orchestra onto their feet, grasping Tasmin Little's left hand in his own, raising it, smiling and her thanks across every member of this audience here. The violin, by the way, she made a new recording of the Delius Concerto for this 150th anniversary year on her own Guadagnini, but this evening she's brought the Strad, the Regent Stradivari from 1708, which is on loan to her from the Royal Academy of Music's instrument collection. And as well as her appearance in the unforgettable Wallace and Gromit prom earlier this season, Tasmin's been in Wales recently, in the USA, and she's just got back from a two-week tour in Australia and Tasmania. She comes across and shakes the hand of Thelma Handy, the orchestra's leader. They're all applauding her now as she bows once again to the promenaders. She's going to be in the recording studio in September. Word is it's going to be another British concerto she's recording this time, and she's preparing a recital of British violin music to record in the autumn as well. And she's going to be playing the Brahms Concerto at Cadogan Hall in London on the 21st of September. I should point out that there's more Delius at the Proms. The Proms Family Orchestra and Northern Sinfonia on hearing the first Cuckoo in Spring. I think that's on Monday. Well, the second half of this evening's BBC Prom brings us music by a composer with whom Vasily Petrenko and his Liverpool Orchestra have been carving out quite a reputation, Dmitri Shostakovich, his 10th symphony. And Petrenko will be sharing his reflections on the work and its Soviet background before we hear it. But we're not breaking the Delius connection just yet, as you're about to find out. It's time to join Matthew Sweet and his guests for this evening's Proms Plus literary event, recorded earlier at the Royal College of Music, just over the road from us here at the Royal Albert Hall.
Hello. Tonight, the Albert Hall resounds to Delius and Shostakovich, but they've played bigger spaces than that. How about the imagination of Ken Russell, a place in which the great composers own harpsichords that spit fire, where showgirls ride the wings of giant biplanes, and where Catherine Oxenberg hangs in her pants above the lair of the white worm. A place which, since Russell's death in November, now only exists in his films. In this programme, we'll explore that place with two people who knew him well. Glenda Jackson, who took direction from him over the course of the decades, from Women in Love and The Music Lovers to The Rainbow and Salome's Last Dance. And the film critic Mark Kermode, a tireless advocate of Russell's work and responsible for healing the cuts sometimes inflicted upon it by the censors. OK, well, let's deal with perhaps a slightly tricky issue at the start. Ken Russell once said, "I think people are afraid to employ me. They think I'm uncontrollable and unbankable, but my imagination is uncontrollable." Is that the right way to characterise him, Glenda Jackson?
I think it would do a disservice to his actual professionalism in a curious way. There wasn't anything on a film set that he couldn't operate. He didn't always operate it at the same time, at the right time, but nonetheless, his actual knowledge of the technical aspects of filmmaking was comprehensive. And he was absolutely concentrated on the work. But he certainly did have a third eye, and he certainly did create, certainly speaking from a selfish point of view as an actress, create the climate in which I could do my work.
How controllable did producers find him, Mark?
Well, I mean, the story is, that as he told it, he was thought of as uncontrollable, but Glenda's absolutely right. You don't make films like a musical like The Boyfriend, or, you know, a rock musical like Tommy, or an extraordinary historical epic like The Devils, or a science fiction movie like Altered States without understanding technically how things work on set. I mean, I was never on set with him, but I've interviewed loads of people who work with him, and they all said the same thing, which was that what you need during any of those productions is a single voice, somebody who will listen to the suggestions of those around them, but in the end is steering the ship, a captain. You know, people describe film sets as being like a boat on the brink of mutiny, and it's the director's job to bring it safely home. He did that time and time again, and no matter how unruly his imagination, no matter how imaginative he could be, he understood the nuts and bolts. You do not make that filmography without the attention to detail that he had.
And he also brought them in on time and on budget.
And on budget, yeah.
That fear that he alluded to was presumably a producer's fear. But what was the actor's attitude to him?
Oh, well, we loved him. I mean, it was just so wonderful to work on a film of his. He didn't direct us. I mean, like all great directors, he knew what he didn't want and was open to suggestion as to what he did. But he never directed. I mean, he would come up to me and he'd say, oh, it's a bit... it needs to be a bit more... And you knew exactly what he meant. And I think... I did. We all did. And I think Liv Ullmann sort of, for me, crystallised what I'm trying to express. She was saying that in a film that she did with Bergman, the scene was she had to walk down a corridor. There was nobody else in the scene. She didn't have a line of dialogue, and she was playing a very vain woman. And so every reflecting surface that she passed, she checked her appearance. And he'd set up the camera to catch it if she did it. And she did it. And that's what I mean with Ken. He could create the climate in which you could do what you could do.
There were certain risks associated with working with him, though, weren't there?
He's like
physical
a lot of,
risks,
yeah,
perhaps.
Like a lot of very good directors. They prove how brave they are by putting their actors through really death-defying incidents. and yes, he did. I mean, but you learnt very quickly never to complain. I can remember on The Music Lovers there was a dream sequence, and the whole cast is appearing in a nightmare for Tchaikovsky. So we all rush out in our period costumes, and he'd got this wind machine, which is actually the propeller from an aeroplane. Fortunately, it's in a cage, but anyway. So we run out and literally were blown off our feet, and I was first out, so I was on the bottom of the pile. So people were being picked up off me, and eventually and he's standing just by my head. And I looked up at him and I said, that was the most fantastic experience of my life, the closest to flying I've ever come. He said, turn the effing wind machine down. Now, if I got up and said, what do you think you're doing? Do you want to kill me? How can I work like this? He'd have said, bring two more wind machines onto the set. I can remember once saying to Christopher Gable, why does he never say cut? And Chris said, because he never knows what you're going to do. And so he gave that space to actors, and if there were something was coming out that, you know, he could use, he'd use it.
Did the private man fit the public persona, you know, the eternal enfant terrible, the mischief maker?
Well, I think that's a great misrepresentation of him. He was an intensely shy and astonishingly sensitive man. And yet, if you treated him as though he was a fool, he would be the greatest fool the world had ever seen. If you thought he was an enfant terrible, he'd break up the room for you. A lot of that was, I think, a carapace to protect what he knew was important in him, and that was his genius.
Can we sketch in a bit of his background, Mark? He was born in Southampton. His father ran a shoe shop.
Yeah, I mean, importantly, you know, he grew up fascinated by this. I mean, one of the things we should talk about, because we're essentially talking about music here, is he did not grow up, at least according to his account, surrounded by classical music. Mm-hmm. He tells this absolutely entrancing story of the first time he experienced what he thought of as classical music, was that he heard something on the radio, and he was completely transfixed by it, and he waited till the end of it to get the name of it. And the way he describes it, he got on his bicycle, pumped up the tires of his bicycle, drove down to the local record store and said, have you got this piece of music? And they went, yep, sure, and they sold it to him, and it was 6 discs, 78. He went home, played it, was overwhelmed, rushed back to the store and said, is there more like this? And the guy turned to the rest of us and went, well, there's all of this. And then he told another story about the first time he ever heard Rites of Spring. And he said he heard Rites of Spring, I think it was on the radio, and he said, and I did what every sane person would have done. And I said, what was that? He said, I took off all my clothes and I danced naked around the living room. And I said, did you really do that? And he looked at me like I was bonkers and said, well, who wouldn't? And in a way, the most extraordinary thing about him is, for somebody who had such an intuitive knowledge and at the end such an encyclopedic knowledge of music, mm-hmm. was not raised in that tradition. One of the great triumphs of what he did was he believed that music was for everybody, whether it's rock music, folk music, sea shanties, which he loved, classical music, you know, opera, whatever it was. He believed that it was for everybody because he had come to it all as a sort of, you know, as an untutored ear. And he would close his eyes and see these pictures, which then eventually became his films, first through his music documentaries and those then for his feature films. And his main idea was, this is for everyone, and I know because I wasn't schooled in it, and yet I get it.
His early career, Mark, takes us back to that rather odd moment when making arts documentaries for the BBC was somehow an entree into the movie business.
Yes. Well, it was extraordinary. I mean, he talks about his very early career. Obviously, he made short films like Amelia and the Angel. He talked very passionately about, you know, his conversion to Catholicism, which he described as turning on a light. Of course, he was a dancer. I mean, people don't remember this, but he did actually dance. And he what he wanted to do with his music documentaries was to express the way he responded to this music, but within a documentary format that broke the documentary format. Now, obviously, when he started, were very strict rules about what you could and couldn't do in depicting the lives of artists. And Ken was always pushing at the boundaries of this. In a way, that's how that early monitor work, that early arts program stuff, feeds into his feature films, things like, for example, The Music Lovers and Mahler and Listomania at the very far end of the spectrum. But with all of them, what he was doing was attempting to dramatize the pictures that he said. I mean, people have used the word synesthesia in connection with Ken, that he would hear music visually. But he was doing it within these very strict confines of what you could and couldn't do in the depiction of an artist's life. And, of course, at times, it caused outrage. You know, when he was making films about Strauss, there were questions in the house. When he was making films about Mahler, there was great controversy about this. But I think what he was always trying to do was to show the audience what was in his head and then tie it back to... It was still documentary, but you watch those films, they are documentaries, but they're poetry, they're visual poetry, they're musical poetry that has a documentary basis.
But also, he, I think, was in a way seminal in bursting many of the pretensions that surround great artists or great genius. I mean, the idea, you know, that they're not human beings, that they have a direct sort of phone line to God, and all they have to do is wait for the genius to come down, and the work is there. And he was absolutely, I thought, brilliant in debunking all that fantasy about what it's like to be a creative artist, because you're under the lash all the time if you're a creative artist. It's no fun at all. I mean, it must be absolutely terrible to be burdened with genius in that way.
Is this what he was doing in The Music Lovers, his Tchaikovsky film? He pitched that to the studio as, it's the story of the marriage between a homosexual and a nymphomaniac. Glenda, you were that nymphomaniac.
I was, indeed, yeah. Yes, I mean, that's, you know, we're talking now about the creative thing, but the other point I think one has to make is that it was, and I think still remains, very difficult to get a film financed, and it doesn't really matter. I can remember John Schlesinger saying to me, I said, where have you been? He said, I've been tap dancing around America trying to raise money for a film. And that was also part and parcel of what, you know, a director had to do, and I think that was something that Ken certainly didn't enjoy.
Was there a sort of musical rhythm to his films, Glenda? I'm thinking that, I mean, in The Music Lovers, I think one of my favourite edits in Ken Russell's body of work is that scene where you are walking along the street and saying to Richard Chamberlain Tchaikovsky, well, we'll go on a long train journey, we'll have a nightcap and we'll have a good night's sleep, cut to you glugging back the champagne in that railway carriage that then begins rocking around all over the place.
Well, I personally, but it's not, wasn't something that I felt when we were actually shooting, but when you saw the films all put together, there always did seem to me to be an intensely musical element. I don't just mean the sound, I mean the kind of rhythms and the colorations of the scenes actually playing out. But we shot that scene and he realized he needed another shot, so he said to me, they built this railway carriage. And we had to come back, and it was me rolling naked on the floor of the railway carriage, and the cameraman and the operator were in the luggage rack, and I'm rolling around. And he was somewhere, Ken was somewhere. And he'd been playing music, and he said, shall I cut the music? So I said, no, don't cut the music. I said, no, I need that. That's great, because the carriage was being manually rocked. And I can't remember the piece. I mean, Mark said he thought it was from The Fiery Angel.
I thought it was Prokofiev,
yeah. I can't remember that. But as I said, you know, if I'd been humming Gershwin, he'd have played Gershwin for me if that had been really what he wanted. But it was, there I am rolling around. The first thing that happened was all the champagne bottles and the glass and the thing crash onto me. Oh, he says, she's fine, she's not bleeding much. Come on, she's not bleeding, it'll never show. So the next thing is there was some beautiful period luggage on the other luggage rack, which was metal, hat boxes. They're the next thing, bang, onto me. The bruises won't show, come on. So we get to the third time, and the next moment is the cameraman is sitting in my lap, and he said to me, I'm a married man. Quite what he thought I was going to do, I don't know, but... But that again, I mean, the kind of rocking of the carriage backwards and forwards, yes, there was a musical element to that.
He saw an overlap between the world of the contemporary rock music of the 1970s, yeah, and the classical composers. So sort of continuity between those two things.
He absolutely did. I mean, if you look at something like Tommy, which pretty much defined what we now think of as the pop video, what he did was he listened to that piece of music, which, oddly enough, the story of Tommy chimed very much with the story that he'd been writing anyway about false idolatry, which was always a big theme of his. You see it in many of his films. And he listened to it and responded to that in exactly the same way that he'd responded to the classical music that had inspired him before. And what's extraordinary about Tommy is it's like the birth of the rock video. It comes fully formed. There's no sense in Tommy that somebody's discovering a new... It's just like, this is it. And it's amazing now when you look at so much MTV and you just go, OK, that's a shot from Tommy, that's a shot from Listomania, that's a shot from... I mean, literally, in those two films, he defined what would then, you know, 30 years later, would still be ringing true. And I think one of the reasons is that he didn't see, this is classical music, this is serious, this is rock music, it's serious. I mean, obviously, Pete Townsend is a very versatile musician anyway, and he and Pete Townsend did get on very, very well. But he didn't see there as being a gap between the two things. They were all part of a continuum. And I think that also feeds into the fact that, you know, later in life he was making his short films, his experimental short films, and one of the things he was doing at one point was making a film in which he was trying to document all the verses of the sea shanty, "'Twas on the Good Ship Venus." This was a great passion for him. He loved sea shanties. They were all part and parcel of the same thing. It's all music. It's all music, no matter what you call it, rock, pop, classical. It's all music.
His career does have a strange sort of symmetry to it, doesn't it? He makes his experimental, his student films. He makes films in Britain. He goes to Hollywood. He comes back. He makes films here again. And then in the last few years of his life, he's making films sort of out of the shed, isn't he? I mean, are we wrong to see this as a story of a rise and fall? Is that too simple a way of looking at it?
I think it is somewhat too simplistic. I mean, the real point of that story is... it is to the undying shame of the British film industry that he was making films in a shed at the bottom of his garden, and the way that, in a sense, he has almost been sidelined. The man who transformed the British film industry, in my view. I mean, up until Ken came along, really, we were still stuck with that terrible, parochial, narrow vision of, I think in a way, a narrow vision of the country, but certainly a narrow view of what film was all about. And he absolutely exploded that. And people, you know, jumped on that bandwagon for a time. But in a way, the fact that he was making films in the shed in his bottom of his garden, it goes back to the point I was making earlier, that terrible, terrible burden of being whipped by your genius, which he was.
But did he really mind being in the shed, Mark? I mean, I remember going down to interview him And he spoke of his studio years almost as a sort of blip. And he said he hadn't enjoyed, he was making a film called Lion's Mouth, yeah. A sort of a kind of musical biopic of the rector of Stewkey, a sort of scandalous figure of the 1920s and 30s. And he said he hadn't enjoyed himself as much since he made Amelia and the Angel, that very early experimental film.
The peculiar thing is, when we were working on the restoration of The Devils, the uncut version of which still has not been released by Warners, because even after all these years, they still consider it too controversial, too fiery for public consumption. But even when he was doing that, he was making what he referred to as his garagiste films. He said, I'm a garagiste, I make films in my garage. And what he loved about it was the control. Not having to do the tap dancing around the producers, not having to fight the battles, he felt like that was a great freedom. And I think he genuinely enjoyed that work and produced some extraordinary work during that period, as much as he enjoyed doing anything else. I completely agree with Glenda that it is outrageous the way that the British film industry didn't show him the respect it should have done. I mean, Fellini once described himself, to Ken, in fact, he said, here in Italy, they call me the Italian Ken Russell. Absolutely. You know, if Fellini was making films in his garage, they'd be having film festivals for it. Absolutely. They'd be, you know, celebrating him as the great maestro. Only here could... It wasn't that Ken was making films in his garage. It was that anybody didn't think that's the most brilliant thing and we must all see what he's been doing because it's Ken Russell.
What would the world have been like if Ken Russell had never been in it? What has he bequeathed us?
Well, I think Glenda is absolutely right that he transformed the British film industry. You know, he called it one of his books, you know, British Picture, and it was a reference to something his mother would say. Is it a British picture? Meaning, you know, is it small and about people making tea? And
exactly.
And he made movies that were classically not British. And they were, you know, as you were saying, the big canvas, the big picture. So I think he gave us that. He had the air of a star as a director. I mean, people nowadays... There's a famous truism, apparently, that if you ask people to name movie stars, they can do it. But if you ask them to name movie directors, they go Steven Spielberg, Stanley Kubrick, Alfred Hitchcock. He was one of those flamboyant directors who you knew, you recognised his vision. He had, everything he touched had his touch on it. And I think even more than that, and I do think this is his enduring legacy, he was somebody who believed absolutely in the power of the work. And no matter what criticism was thrown at him, no matter what snipes were thrown at him by the critical establishment, no matter what financial difficulties he may have had, he never, ever, ever lost faith in the truth of the work. He passionately believed in his films and he passionately believed in cinema. And, I mean, I think that's his enduring legacy. He was an artist. He was an artist working in an industry.
Absolutely. And he never cheated. And he never lied, and he struggled, as all great artists do, to tell the truth in a medium which is quite difficult to tell the truth in quite often. And I go back to the point I was making earlier. I mean, of his BBC films, as I've said, my favourite is Isadora. I think Vivian Pickles is absolutely superb in it, but it's a superb film because it tells the truth about what it's like to be a performing artist, because he cuts away all the fantasy and all the romanticism. And he does that, I think, in all his films. And they are not only informed by the passion for the work, but something which I don't think has been recognized sufficiently in him. He was passionate about man's inhumanity to man. He was absolutely apoplectic about how dreadful we can be to each other. And that is in all his films somewhere.
And if I may add to that, that is at the core of The Devils,
absolutely,
which was given a terrible run, but is, as far as he's concerned, a film about exactly that
absolutely
subject.
Absolutely.
Mark Kermode, Glenda Jackson, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Matthew Sweet presented this evening's Proms literary event on the work of director Ken Russell, and the producer was Gavin Hurd. You're listening to BBC Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms. I'm Andrew McGregor, live at the Royal Albert Hall for this evening's visit from the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra and its chief conductor, Vasily Petrenko, with whom they've been making something of a speciality of Shostakovich's symphonies, on disc and in concert. Now, the whole of the second half of the Prom is taken up with Shostakovich's 10th symphony, the first of the cycle to emerge after Joseph Stalin's death in 1953, and for many commentators, its four movements are inescapably associated with Shostakovich's experience of the Stalin years, the terrors and the purges. But what about Petrenko? Like Shostakovich, he was born, brought up and studied in Leningrad.
Yes, I always felt very close to his music. It's in my veins, it's in my blood, and when I'm conducting it, and I'm conducting it a lot now on the West, I always have pictures in my imagination of Leningrad as it's been by then. Of course, the city's changed now in a good side because it's cleaner, safer, etc., but it's lost its character a little bit. And all those periods in the history, all throughout the life of Shostakovich, are very fascinating, and how he have written the symphonies and had written basically autobiopic over 60 years is fascinating, and it's absolutely unprecedented.
And when it comes to the cycle of the symphonies, what do you think is the place of the 10th symphony musically speaking? It's a very considerable moment
in the
cycle.
It's one of the most popular symphonies in the world. It's one of the most playable symphonies. And of course, it's a great music and one of the symphonies which shaped in very fascinating way. So you can see the architecture of the symphony clearly done. There's similarity in the structure of the movements. There's similarity in the relations between the themes, between the subjects, between first and third movement, for instance. The language is very different. Very meditative first movement and very grotesque, sardonic third movement, but relation between the themes are nearly the same, and the shape, the amount of time spent on exploration of one theme or another. It's also have fantastic orchestral colorings. There's some things which he found in this symphony which never happened before. Technique of the strings playing. It's the symphony which has probably most down bows alongside of all his symphonies. And they're quite fast passages which he insisted to play down bow because he wanted this special sound.
And what about this orchestra? Are they playing like Russians yet?
Of course they do. what I like in Liverpool is that they do have some influence of Russian character, of course. But they also have the British character, of course. And combination of two, that's something very unique. I must say, in many ways, the British passion in the character is very close to the Russian passion in the character. It has no boundaries when it goes to the point. But it has its discipline, sometimes more than the Russian orchestra. It has its nobility, which also not always happened in the Russian orchestra. So I would say it's a combination of two countries or two characters from different countries, which makes it very unique.
Vasily Petrenko on his favourite Russian orchestra in the UK, the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic, which is on stage at the Royal Albert Hall right now. And here he comes, Petrenko, who's been reminding them all earlier today of life in Leningrad in the 1950s. And he's about to conduct Shostakovich's 10th symphony.
Thank you.
Shostakovich's personal musical signature, DSCH, stamped defiantly all over the end of his Symphony No. 10 from 1953. Shostakovich perhaps forcefully making the point that for all the fear, the criticism, the persecution and the desolation that opens that last movement, he won, he outlived the dictator Stalin. The Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra, led this evening by Thelma Handy, conducted by Chief Conductor Vasily Petrenko. Walking back onto the platform to the cheers of the promenaders and the applause of his own orchestra. Music stands being tapped enthusiastically. And Petrenko gets the brass section to stand. And then timpanist Neil Hitt. His career chose him, I think. Principal horn player Timothy Jackson. The rest of the horn section now taking their call. Bassoonist Alan Pendlebury. Oboist Jonathan Small. Korongo player Rachel Pankhurst all getting their turn in the spotlight. The clarinet section led by Catherine Lacey. Flautists and piccolo player Cormac Henry and Fiona Patterson. And a kiss for Thelma Handy leading the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra. Petrenko's, well, he's a tall man, long arms, very fluid gestures and then fluid stick technique as well. He has really supple wrists and the fingers of his left hand are constantly communicating to the players. And balletic poise on the rostrum. It's probably all those years conducting the ballet in St. Petersburg. I read somewhere that he reckons he's conducted Swan Lake 150 times or thereabouts, although he might have been exaggerating for effect. Well, we've had three works this evening spanning almost a century. Each composer in their way touched by conflict. The Deliuses escaping their French home ahead of the German army in 1915. Shostakovich, silenced as a symphonist by Stalin's post-war terror, finding his voice after the dictator's death. And Sir Peter Maxwell Davis's Ninth Symphony, coloured by his reaction to military intervention in the Middle East. A fascinating range of sounds and ideas. From Max in Italy to Shostakovich in Leningrad. And as Vasily Petrenko bows low to the audience here in the Royal Albert Hall, the next combination of name and place is James Jolly back in Broadcasting House.
Thank you, Andrew. That was Andrew McGregor at the Royal Albert Hall. And there's another chance to hear tonight's prom on Tuesday, the 4th of September at 2 in the afternoon here on BBC Radio 3. We return to the Royal Albert Hall for our next prom tomorrow night when we've a performance of Peter Grimes by Benjamin Britten with soloists and the forces of English National Opera conducted by Edward Gardner. The performance begins at 7 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3.
Searing psychological drama, Peter Grimes.
Now's our chance. The whole sea's boiling. Get the nets. Come, boy.
A work that established a new tradition in English opera and an acclaimed ENO production that's been playing to packed houses since 2009.
We're going to sea.
Britain's Peter Grimes from the BBC Proms. Tomorrow night on BBC Radio 3 from 7 o'clock.
Now, we've not had any vocal music this evening, so I thought I'd put that to rights before our 10 o'clock feature with a group of songs by someone who was perhaps one of the greatest influences on the music of one of the composers we've heard this evening, Frederick Delius. The composer in question is Edvard Grieg, and we're going to hear his Hjertets Melodia, or Melodies of the Heart. It's a quartet of songs, Two Brown Eyes, A Poet's Heart, the very famous I Love You, and My Thoughts Are Like a Mighty Mountain. The singers, Katarina Karneus.
Dear Flamets, kneel thou bow
The Four Melodies of the Heart by Edvard Grieg. The singer was Katerina Karnaeus, and Julius Drake played the piano. And tomorrow afternoon, on Afternoon on Three from 2 o'clock, you can hear a repeat of the Proms performance from a couple of Sundays ago of Schoenberg's Gurrelieder, in which Katerina Karnaeus sang the Wood Dove, and she was joined by Simon O'Neill, Angela Danoka, Neil Davis, Jeffrey Lloyd Roberts and Wolfgang Schoener. The forces of the BBC, expanded BBC Symphony Orchestra and Choruses, is conducted by Jukka-Pekka Saraste. That's 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. Now, here's a few words from Andrew McGregor about one of the proms next week.
A composer renowned for choral music that's winning ever wider audiences. On BBC Radio 3, Eric Whittaker makes his proms debut in the late-night showcase for which the BBC singers join forces with his own vocal ensemble. The programme includes Whittaker's new work inspired by the Olympic motto, Citius Altius Fortius, faster, higher, stronger. Eric Whittaker at the BBC Proms, on Radio 3 this Wednesday night at 10:15.
This is BBC Radio 3. It's just gone 10 o'clock. Now, walking with attitude. Psychogeography was invented by the French situationists in the 1950s. But in recent years, the word has started turning up in style magazines and colour supplements. But what does it mean? Novelist and travel writer Ian Marchant tries to find out.
On the 6th of March 1956, the situationist Guy Debord and Gil Volman came wandering through the 11th arrondissement in search of psychogeographical enlightenment, trying to get lost, trying to defamiliarise themselves with their own city. This is an area that they found repulsively petty bourgeois. On one level, they were just two drunk avant-garde French artists wandering about from bar to bar. On another level, this project has come to be seen as revolutionary, as a completely new way of addressing the city. As a personal project, you reinvent yourself at the same time as the city is reinvented around you. And this, apparently, is psychogeography. Whoa! Red light. Came very close to ending up in a Parisian hospital there. Which would have been a sort of way of getting lost, I guess. For several years now, psychogeography has been a word worth dropping into conversation if you want to impress with your cultural street smarts. More interesting than the oxbow lakes of your own school geography, and more hip than the human geography your own kids do, such as studying footfalls in shopping centres, psychogeography sounds edgy, which it might be if you could work out what it was. It was invented by situationist Guy Debord, and in Paris, I spoke to Debord's biographer, Andrew Hussey.
Debord said that the word came to him when he'd taken some hashish, and he was wandering through the Jardin des Plantes, and he was so stoned that he couldn't find his way out, so he decided to stay in the park and explore its inner recesses. So it was a journey into the inner mind, as well as the city.
He called it pleasingly vague. Is it too vague? Does it have any meaning at all, do you think?
It does have a meaning. And the idea is that the city, as you wander through it, is endlessly changing as you penetrate the different levels of atmosphere and as those atmospheres have an effect on you. Now, not all of those atmospheres are pleasant. They can be awe, they can be boredom, they can be melancholy. So the vagueness is actually to do with the endlessly fluid nature of the city, which is always moving.
So this is the Rue Oberkampf, and we're heading across the 11th arrondissement, Jolly and the producer and I. We're not exactly lost. They were lost. We, weirdly, are following in their footsteps. There are lingerie shops, which is always welcome. But is it, I don't know if my psyche's being changed, that's the thing. That's one of the things I simply don't understand. Who has sufficient access to their consciousness to say, oh, I'm feeling mordant, or, you know, lachrymose or something, as opposed to, oh, I've never been here before. Debord calls somewhere depressingly picturesque, and I find this quite picturesque. Just exactly the sort of charmant little area that you'd boast to your friends about when you go home and say, oh, I don't know if you know the 11th arrondissement. It's marvellous. We found the Rue Oberkamp. So it seemed to them, I guess, deeply inauthentic. Whereas to an English bloke, it seems deeply authentically Parisian.
But what the Situationists believed was that we are imprisoned in what they call the society of the spectacle. And where we're standing right here, if I just turn to my left, you can see all the right bank, which is commodity, commerce, the spectacle of consumerism, and they hated all of that. And what they wanted to do is develop techniques, strategies, situations, which were ways of resisting the control of the spectacle in our lives. And if I turn to the right, which actually I'm pointing to the left bank, that was the playground for the Situationists, where they practiced this thing called psychogeography.
So what is the spectacle then?
Guy Debord says that everything that once was truly lived has now moved away into representation. And if you think about it, that's true, that we live in a society where we're surrounded by more images, more visual culture than ever before. Now, the idea of the spectacle can be traced back to Paris in the 1850s, when Baron Haussmann reinvented the city with the great boulevards. This was the first modern designer city in the world. You could walk the boulevards and consume with your eyes the spectacle of things that you might want to buy, which could range from a newfangled kettle to a prostitute. Now, the flaneur, the man who wandered through the city in that way, was consuming the spectacle in that way. The Situationists kind of turned that on its head, because what they wanted to do was create a way of wandering through the city, the dérive, which means in French the drift, in which you were led by your own unconscious desires rather than desires that were given to you by capitalist economics.
Walking up the Rue Oberkampf, the first thing they saw that they liked was at 160, Delicatessen Provision A Breton.
Bonjour.
What's now at 160 Rue Oberkampf is a phone shop called Phonio. And in a way, the phony is what Debord meant by the spectacle, that the spectacle was phony. Was authenticity to do with the working class? I mean, on the dérives, did they meet people? Were they engaging with people?
I think what Debord was interested in was not so much the working class, and he wasn't somebody who was actually going to do a lot of work himself, but what the French historian Louis Chevalier calls les classes dangereuses, the dangerous classes. Revolution is not going to come from the working class, that's all finished, but from the dangerous classes, the outlaws, the sexual transgressors, the misfits, the drunks, the anarchists.
What are we looking for?
I suppose we're looking for dangerous lowlifes like this gentleman here, who's just but a kind of old tramp whose head is covered in open sores and a couple of packs of the French equivalent of special brew. And we have turned the corner and there are homeless people and Middle Eastern shops and an abandoned lavatory on the street. But it's still very nice.
They would find themselves in the company of refugees from the Spanish Civil War in a bar in Aubervilliers. They'd find themselves in a place where drugs were sold by Algerians in the 1950s.
Lads playing football. Bonjour.
On passe à la télé?
Ah, non.
C'est la radio.
La radio, oui. Radio Angleterre. I can't really speak French. It's the most French I've ever used. And it doesn't go anywhere, it goes to a hotel. So, you know, we've come out of a dodgy old bit and back into somewhere that one can only describe as repulsively petty bourgeois. Did we meet any dangerous people? I suppose there were some dodgy-looking characters. Did we try and buy hashish or opium off them? Not really. Should we have done in order to do the authentic thing? Perhaps we should go back. I think the license payers might draw the line. Anyway, here we are, Avenue Simon Bolivar. Wonder where we go next. The Situationists didn't leave a lot of psychogeographic writing behind, and what they did sometimes seems a bit, well, pedestrian. Debord did produce a couple of psychogeographic maps where he cut up the map of Paris and stuck it back together in ways that represented psychogeographic reality. I'm a travel writer. I guess I've been trying to track down what's the difference between what a travel writer does and psychogeography, given that I go to places that I haven't been before, I kind of get lost, I meet people I haven't met before, I'm trying to find out about the place, and I'm an old punk rocker.
I think it hits on something really important here, because What it's all about, I think, is atmosphere, isn't it? It's about the, if you like, the politics of atmosphere and, you know, the dead eve, psychogeography. It's about trying to find atmospheres in the city and then trying to understand what they mean. And you can do that, you know, from Paris to Wigan. You know, there's all meanings to be uncovered in the city. And there's a great book by the Spanish novelist Juan Goiti Solo called Paisajes Después de la Tierra, Landscapes After the Battle, in which he borrows this from Guy Debord. Everybody wakes up in Paris one day to find that the whole of the Roman alphabet has been replaced by Arabic. And of course, the people who live in Paris, the Parisians, cannot understand the city that they live in. Yeah. The only people who can understand it are the bin men, the people working in low-grade jobs, the dangerous classes, the Arabic readers. The meaning of the city is flipped over. And this is what the maps were about for Guy Debord. They're about flipping over into different types of experience, which could be disorientating, it could be alienating, it could be exhilarating. But it was about reinventing a sense of place.
We've arrived at the Place de Bataille, Stalingrad, and here's the curve of the overhead metro line, which they describe as being charming. This is the impressive rotunda, and they call this a psycho-geographical hub. And although they went on from here, we're probably going to have to finish here, especially since the Situationist on their derive says, as darkness descends, they finally decide to put an end to a dérive that they deem to be of little interest as such. But there, we've done it. We've followed in the footsteps of Debord and Volman. And I'm pleased to say that over there by the Canal Martin, there's a café bar, and this is very important because Debord and Volman, frankly, were drunk for the whole of their dérive, and we've come to the end of our dérive, and I'm not saying that we're going to get drunk, but perhaps we could go and get a nice cup of tea.
There is a kind of dandyish quality to the drift, the Situationist's act of wandering around like gentlemen of leisure.
Alastair Bonnet, Professor of Geography at Newcastle University.
I think what is interesting about psychogeography over the years is it has moved on. It's moved away from this urban avant-garde groupuscule to become something much more important and engaged with a much wider constituency of people. So I tend to look at psychogeography as having its backstory, essentially, with the French post-war avant-garde. But then really coming alive, really quite recently, from the 1990s onwards.
What brings it back to life, do you think?
Well, I think there's two reasons.
Yeah.
I think the first one is that the glamour of distance has faded and travel to distant locales has become almost banal. And what that means is that the place around the corner, ordinary landscapes, have gained some of the glamour. That's one reason, but I think there's another, and that is the profound dissatisfaction that many people feel with the contemporary city, a sense that the non-place urban realms that many of us live in are just not humanly satisfying. So it's no wonder that people are searching for adventure, for the mysterious, for connection. And they are using some of the techniques of psychogeography, but also going way beyond it to turn their ordinary landscapes into spaces of adventure.
If Paris was the centre of the first wave, the golden age of psychogeography, the second wave from the 1980s onwards was in London. The central figures were writers Ian Sinclair and Will Self. Sinclair started off not with politics but fiction, and his novel Lud Heat was hugely influential for the coming new wave of psychogeographers.
I was working as a gardener in Limehouse and Wapping and along the river, and just because I was cutting grass in Hawksmoor churches, you could see in this what was pretty much a derelict kind of landscape at that time. These great block churches were immense presences, and they seemed to me to connect, and there were lines and patterns that grew out from that. And so combining a kind of work diary of what it was like to work as a labourer through the area with speculations about these churches and about patterns of energy in a city created a kind of bouillabaisse of a form, which I think had some kind of influence on some of the people who later became psychogeographers. And it was only years later that I dropped the term psychogeography into the more documentary works I was doing, because it seemed very appropriate to that political moment. This was a very useful sort of satiric tool at the beginning of a book called Lights Out for the Territory, where I start to actually do very specific walks, a V sign across London, recording graffiti that can only be described as a psychogeographic exercise.
Sinclair became seen as the silverback of Silver Age psychogeography, but its writer Will Self, who popularised the term, with a column in The Independent called Psychogeography.
Sinclair comes to it, it seems to me, with the fully blown sensibility of the kind of English romantic mystic, albeit in a rather straight-laced form, our kind of contemporary William Blake in some way. You know, he's constantly striding out and looking down to the Clerkenwell Road and seeing dark satanic mills, and he's willing to give headspace to concepts like ley lines or lines of force or kind of mystic underbelly to the urban experience that I don't really click into in that way. I came at it from a different angle. I grew up in a walking household. My father was a big walker, but I kind of rather lost that during the drug taking and the drinking years, and was a big car driver. And what I was preoccupied by was liminal parts of city, the kind of strange hinterland of cities where they kind of fade into the countryside, really kind of preoccupied me a lot in my 20s and 30s. And I mean, I can remember going out in the 1980s to places like the Isle of Grain and kind of being quite preoccupied by these, but having no real acquaintance with the literature or any of the theoretical superstructure at all, just having a kind of visceral and sentimental feel for these places. You know, ideally, what I like to do with, I think, appropriate homage to Sinclair, you know, the thing I've mostly done over the last decade has been these kind of radial walks out from the centre of London for kind of 60, 100, 120 miles into the hinterland of the city, so that I can take these kind of biopsies or tissue samples or apprehend the stratigraphy of the urban, the suburban, the liminal, and then the countryside itself.
You talk about doing long urban walks, and I guess I've hung about on suburban stations in various states of intoxication. Could you remember when doing long urban walks or hanging about on suburban stations became psychogeography? Can you sort of pin down when...
Well, it is interesting, isn't it? I mean, if you look back, and Sinclair is undoubtedly the pivotal figure, I don't think I started to hear the term bandied about really a lot until the late 90s.
The word has become so common in certain circles that some putative psychogeographers have become embarrassed by it. One of them is Will Self's friend and collaborator, Nick Papadimitriou. He's writing a book about his own North London edgelands.
We're in Edgware, outside the Broadwalk Shopping Centre, with Nick Papadimitriou. And we're going on a walk. Are we going on a derive, would you say?
Unfortunately, it's not a derive because I know precisely where we'll be going, although you don't. I believe a derive is a walk wherein you get lost.
So, are you a psychogeographer?
I have no idea. Some people call me a psychogeographer, and people who call themselves psychogeographers incline towards being my friend, but I tend to think of myself as more as a deep topographer.
I like the line, some of my best friends are psychogeographers.
They think they're my friends, I'm not so sure myself.
So, we're going to walk. Where are you taking us?
I'm taking you out of what might pass as being the dullest sort of suburbia, but the main purpose of the walk today is to show you the transition from what could be taken as the northern edge of London onto the Scarp, which is the project I'm covering in my book of the same name, Scarp, in order to show you how this long line of hills does actually exist and isn't just a figment of my imagination, despite the fact that it has no cultural presence whatsoever. Unfortunately, the North Middlesex South Hertfordshire Tertiary Escarpment is overshadowed by...
It's a rubbish name, in fairness.
Well, I beg your pardon, Ian. I think there's something destabilising about thinking of a place within walking distance of the northern reaches of London as having such a grand geological title. I really object to your comment.
Nick started deep topography as a kind of personal therapy.
I found when I started walking in the late 80s that I was having a magnitude of experience that I couldn't find any reference to in most of the ramblers' guides and the like that I turned to in order to find identification. So I figured that I was either going through something that was entirely new or that it was just something that people hadn't been able to or hadn't felt was important enough to describe. And I put it to myself that it was my job to try and describe that. So as a writer, that's the sort of thing I try and do. And it's very difficult. I'm inventing new ways of expressing landscape as I go along.
Oh, no. Wow. Ooh. Is this the North Circular?
No, it's the A41T Barnet, Watford Bypass. Oh. And that's Edgware Bury Lane. It's beginning to run uphill. You can see that we've been climbing steadily for about half a mile now, and we've attained a bit of a height, and we're going to get higher. And we're just about to enter an area of green belt, albeit green belt that's intersected by motorways and railway lines and arterial roads.
Because we've come to the exact moment where the pavement has stopped on one side of the road, and this side of the road suddenly looks kind of rural.
Well, this is the edge of London.
Do you know what? I really believe you. It looks like it. It feels like it. It's a really fascinating feeling.
Further up the hill, we'll come to Clay Lane. There were tramp murders up there in the 1930s. And further down the hill, Daniel Raven lived, who murdered his parents-in-law. There were plenty of other murders in the area as well.
Yeah. It seems to me sometimes, if psychogeography, one of the ways it differs from local history, perhaps, is it's very interested in the dark side.
Well, as it happens, I wrote a book called Foul Deeds and Suspicious Deaths in Barnet, Hendon and Finchley for Pen and Sword. That was my first book. I think psychogeography is an attempt to destabilise normalcy. And one of the ways that you can relish doing that in a suburb is to point out that that house over there was the scene of a murder. Specific things that make up the identity of places and add to their presence if you know about them. I mean, I happen to know when I walked up here one time about 10 years ago, I accidentally trod on a beetle that was crossing the road. And yeah. I nearly always think about that when I walk up here, because that's kind of a big event for the beetle.
Nick calls this hyperparticularity. He knew the names of the ducks in the farmyards. Where there weren't names for features of scarp, he had invented them. I'm a bit puffed up. We've clearly walked up something. How much do you think scarp is a product of your imagination?
Scarp tends to fade and then reconcretize for me. Sometimes I can't see it. Sometimes I wonder if it's coherent enough an entity to justify writing a book about it.
You're walking in this landscape, if you like, for a purpose, with attitude. You're a punk walker. And I wondered, you know, the extent to which you bring your imagination to play on the landscape. You are, to some extent, making this landscape up as a deep topographer.
I'm ill-equipped to define the difference between reality and imagination, I must admit.
As we reached the top of Scarp, Nick knew a shortcut through the woods to where we could get a bus back to Edgware.
It should take us into the churchyard. I've got my phone so we can get rescue services. That's the way we came from. I have no idea. Right way. Track to the church, please. We are straightforwardly lost.
I got us lost.
Okay.
And we hoped that there was a track down towards the church.
It's a very long walk. You come all the way down there, but it's private property.
Oh.
So you're not allowed down there. So I'll cut you out this door here.
That's
and
really kind.
And then get to the end and you'll see a massive gate. Yep. Turn right and the church is just there.
Thank you.
We're making a documentary for Radio 3. So we ended up with a proper Debord East derive after all. One man who celebrates and has reinvented situationist psychogeography is the artist, filmmaker, writer and pamphleteer Stuart Holme. He read Ian Sinclair, was influenced by him and ended up influencing him back.
Sinclair couldn't believe it when he was sent a pile of my books and wanted to meet me. And obviously when I met him, I gave him a lot of bump written by various people. Me and also a friend of mine called Richard Essex, who revived the London Psychogeographical Association.
We need a bit of backstory here. The London Psychogeographical Association never really existed. It was just a name dreamt up by the British Situationist artist Ralph Rumney in 1957. And as soon as it was created, it was merged into the Situationist International and ceased to exist. Back to Stuart Home and his friend Richard Essex.
He'd been living out on the Isle of Dogs and became convinced that the pyramid at the top of Canary Wharf was a virtual triangle, and there was this huge ley line that ran through the whole of the British Isles that went through there. So Ian was very taken with this material, what he was doing. You could call psychogeography in a certain respect anyway, but started using the term and picking up on it.
Yeah. So are you the London Psychogeographical Association, or is there such a thing?
Yes, there was such a thing, but I'm not it. There was a bit of confusion because Ian didn't realise that all the material I gave him wasn't by me, so he wrote about it as being mine. I mean, he understands the score now, but there was an initial confusion. So a lot of people then thought I was the London Psychogeographical Association, which I'm not, but it was just one person. And I mean, the revival of that group, was this friend of mine, Richard Essex, who he'd been looking at De Boer's writing. When he saw that De Boer said that the only useful form of theory or knowledge was an unacceptable theory, he thought, ah, the occult. So he'd kind of plug the idea of psychogeography into ley lines.
Who is this mysterious Richard Essex, friend of Stuart Home? It turns out to be a pseudonym, we think, for Fabian Tompsett, self-described cultural worker. Ian Sinclair sees Stuart and Fabian as situationist wannabes.
I think very much this second wave of psychogeography was very much to do with radical nostalgia. Fabian and Stuart Home, both of them, were nostalgic for sort of cultural moments that they'd missed, which was glamorous. So they gave themselves honorary membership of the Situationists. And the way of becoming part of it was to recycle it or Xerox it. And it was radical in the sense that it was picking up on something that was out of the common parlance at that moment and giving it a way of directly addressing specifics of a BNP councillor being voted in Tower Hamlets. And so you take his house and you blast these psychogeographic paths or ley lines through that house, and you summon people down to the top of Greenwich Hill to enact a magical working against Prince Charles or whatever it is that you do. It had a kind of either genuinely radical or kind of cod radical aspect to it.
It's been described as magical Marxism. Alastair Bonnet, Professor of Real Geography at Newcastle, was a collaborator with Fabian Tompsett.
They, in a way, often script psychogeography as an elaborate game, almost a set of hoaxes. The interest in the occult that you find in the London Psychogeographical Association really pushed the boundaries, tracing ley lines between sites of class power. Now, one could look at this just as a form of play, but one can also look at it in terms of Marx's explanation of the fetishistic character of capitalism. In a way, the magico-Marxists were looking at capitalism as a dark religion in which fetishism has been developed and expanded, not just into the commodity world, but across the field of power relations. And these metaphors are taken literally within magico-Marxism, and so capitalism becomes this dark secret which only the occult operations of the magico-Marxists can open up. So there's something quite bewildering about that, something quite unnerving, and I never bought into it, but it seemed like a new way of doing politics. But at the end of the day, it also seemed to be making fun of class politics. It seemed to be making fun of revolutionary activity. To turn it into this sort of elaborate game is, in a sense, to undermine and subvert this tradition. So it's an interesting phenomenon in which the left and socialism no longer have a serious place within the political landscape, and therefore people can start playing games with it.
But do they believe any of it? Will Self?
Well, I think that's a very good point. I mean, I've stood with Ian by Greenwich Observatory and looked down on the Isle of Dogs and had him talk about some sort of cosmological feng shui that was terminally disrupted by the construction of Canary Wharf, and you really can't tell, even when you're standing right next to him, the extent to which he actually believes this. In a way, I have to say, I really hope he does, because otherwise it becomes a bit of a shtick, doesn't it?
But could it be a sort of situationist playfulness?
I suppose so, but, you know, as Montaigne says, mistrust a man who takes games too seriously. It means he doesn't take life seriously enough, you know, I mean. And this stuff is kind of serious, actually. It is serious, the way that public space is eroded, the way in which the physicality of your environment becomes wound round by razor wire and obliterated by the progress of mass transit systems. These are actually kind of serious things.
And yet, psychogeography does seem inherently playful, even if it has serious intent.
One of the exercises that is most associated with psychogeography is using a map of one place to guide your way around another.
Yeah.
And the Situationists used a map of the Berlin Underground to find their way around Paris. And I went once on an exercise using the map, again, of the Berlin Underground to find my way around Newcastle, and ended up walking through various doors and entrances where I felt very nervous, and going to places which I wouldn't normally go to. And that is the point.
One of the things the psychogeographers talk about is dangerous places and liminality. And we thought, where would be the most banal place to go? Where would be the safest place to go? And what could be safer than Beaconscott Model Village in Beaconsfield? Especially since it's closed. Yesterday was the last day it was open, and they've let us in to come and wander about Beaconscott using a map of Legoland to try and get lost. And over here, look, according to this map of Legoland, this would be the hill train, but there is a train track here. Then we go this way into Beaconscott proper, and we're entering the zone called Greenhaley. There are people playing cricket, and there's a blacksmith called C. Bellows. Now, on the Lego map, this is called the Circus Show. Here to our right is the college bookshop and the baker. There's a little market down there. But I don't think we'd meet dangerous people. On this map of Legoland, we're now in my town and looking down towards the town harbour, and blow me down, that's exactly what we're doing here at Beaconscott. There is a harbour over there. What would De Boer have made of this? I think he'd have liked this particular view, because it's pleasingly un-petty bourgeois, because I'm looking over railway sidings and there's a miniature chemical factory. There's a nodding donkey oil pump thing, and he said, you know, the view of Versailles would be much better if there was a factory between the palace and the fountain. Nice to see the stark modernity of the chemical plant, I guess. It's fantastic. He'd have liked that. But in Legoland terms, this is the puppet theatre. Now we're going to do a transgressive one, because our next turn takes us over a gate. Says quite clearly, no entry. So, hello. Even though it says no entry, we're coming through. Do you know what I mean? Pass where the 5th Beaconscott Brownies are dancing the maypole. Don't tread on this bus either. So we're still looking to make... this is well liminal. We've come behind the facade. We found the garbage area. There are rubbish bags and trolleys and sheds and storage areas. And this is where the public don't come. And certainly this is contested space. We tried to have a bit of fun with Beaconscott, but psychogeography seems constantly to teeter on the line between political critique and absurdist leg pull. One of the newest generation of self-confessed psychogeographers who's trying to use Debordy's techniques for semi-practical purposes is John Rogers in High Wycombe.
Wycombe is the first place westwards where the gravitational pull of London ends. So you're freed from the vortex that is this city, the great power node. And when I was living abroad, I was looking for some information on my hometown for some work I was doing. and I came across the plans for the new town centre redevelopment, and they were utterly unrecognisable from the place that I knew. And there was no space in there for any kind of subjective or human impression of the town. So I worked with my sister, who's a public artist, and we got some funding from the Arts Council to do a project to study how people's sense of identity is developed through their connection with place. So first we wanted to map the movements of an office worker who was working in the area that was being redeveloped. And we recorded his movements over a week preceding a derive that he did with an algorithm, which is a simple set of instructions, which is first left, second right, first left, and then repeat that instruction. You would just purely have to follow the algorithm. And it frees you from that decision-making.
Were people interested? Were they keen? People were keen, actually. The local newspaper gave it quite good coverage. So we were able to get lots of sort of like situationist theory into the Bucks Free Press. And the mayor of High Wycombe came and he declared that our grand derive had started with a chain of office and a gown.
De Boer, I suppose, saw himself as very much on the left. But sometimes when you read their critiques of city centres or even town centres, they're kind of conservationist.
In High Wycombe, we did clash with the Wycombe Society. They didn't really want to have anything to do with us, and they're the kind of traditional conservation people.
Yeah, why didn't they want anything to do with you, though?
I think the reason is what we would say is that a bus shelter in a busy part of the town is as important as the Georgian Town Hall. It has heritage, it has stories, it has a connection to people's lives. Significant events in their lives happen in that bus shelter, whereas actually some of them have never been in the Georgian Town Hall.
So is psychogeography a way to get people to overcome alienation?
Absolutely.
And overcoming things like boredom.
Boredom and banality are the enemies of the human spirit, aren't they?
Yeah.
I think settlement in place, and I think connecting to place, is a great foundation for well-being and happiness and sort of spiritual growth and human growth.
Which sounds a little bit like the government's well-being agenda. And psychogeography has made its way deep into academia too. At the Chorley Institute at University College London, psychogeographer Christian Nold has an invention that he straps to volunteers in an attempt to do with science what De Boer did with alcohol.
Basically, people are going for a walk with this device which combines a lie detector with the GPS unit.
Right.
So what it does, it records how you're feeling as well as your location. And this is stored on the device and you can download this and then you can visualise it as a map. So we can really literally do emotional cartography.
You know, in the original conception, if you like, the situationist conception of psychogeography, there would be the spooky area and the happy area. Can you begin to map that psychogeographical city, if you like?
The device that I developed, what it does, it basically maps physiological arousal, which is kind of a bit more primitive than the spooky area or anything like that. It's literally intensity, how your body is reacting to something. And what's really exciting is when people see this visualized for them, you know, after they've gone for a walk for an hour, it suddenly triggers their memory of that particular
right.
experience. And then suddenly they add the qualitative stuff onto it. You know, how did they feel about it? What was going on there? Were they walking past their house? Did they see somebody they fancied in the distance? So it's the richness of the stories that they're kind of co-constructing with this stuff that I think is really exciting. That's how you can start getting to what I think of as psychogeography. But you can also see the larger patterns. So it was really clear, for example, in San Francisco, because you have these nice grid layouts, basically really forces people into these kind of very particular clumps. And you can really see how people's arousal goes up as they're going to traffic junctions, basically.
Gosh.
I mean, it was the little pocket parks. These are things that don't appear on any maps, and it's fascinating. These are little local parks that only local people know about, and things like mural roads. These are roads that have lots of incredible graffiti on that, you know, I wouldn't know going there, but they suddenly appear as really big red splodges on these maps. I really love it how these little local treasures start to appear on these maps.
And yet, it could all get a bit sinister.
For a while, I was getting something like 5 emails a day from all sorts of people, you know, advertising companies wanting to rebrand cities. So these people are also interested in how we feel and interact with space and how we perceive it. So they certainly want to be able to, you know, slice our heads open and kind of see what's rolling around inside.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting and powerful but dangerous area where Psychogeography, the way that people talk about it, is definitely about the individual speaking and gaining knowledge, but I definitely think there's lots of people out there who really see it as a kind of marketing.
So what is psychogeography? Is it really just plain old geography? A branch of town planning? Or an avant-gardist put-on? Will Self.
Of course, it's a very broad church and it's not even a field and it's too much of a practice. You can't study it, you can only do it. You know, it seems to me that it is very much of the zeitgeist. So for me, it comes down to this thing that people find rather nauseating about it, that a lot of people who are interested in the practice and who do practice it seem to have a kind of romantic anti-romanticism. So there's a kind of hatred of certain aspects of modernity and of the contemporary world, and at the same time a kind of rather revolting joy in the fact of being against them, you know, kind of walking along motorways and kind of contemplating kind of grotty, run-down, semi-detached houses. And I find myself doing it, going into sort of strange ecstasies of, frankly, rather maudlin sentimentality. But I think that's all well and good. I mean, I think the thing is to be aware that is a pitfall, and to rejoice in the good things. It wasn't until I started seriously doing long urban walks that I started to really apprehend cities for what they were. Before then, they were essentially incoherent. And the fact of the matter is, if everybody did it, the world would be a lot better place. Even if only a significant minority of people did this sort of thing, the world would indubitably be a better place.
Ian Sinclair has abandoned the term.
I think, personally, its moment has passed and it's become wholly decadent and it kind of filters out into the reaches of academia and little booklets and all of that, and it's already inert and gone by the time it gets there. I think what we want is just someone alert to particulars, alert to the qualities of plays, and alert to real geography rather than psychogeography. I mean, the geography of Hackney is why Hackney is Hackney, and I've become very interested in a new version of it called psychogeology. That's what I'm really into now. And I did the last project I undertook or derived was to follow from a huge rock that was put down in Shoreditch Park for no apparent reason, which is a lump of granite from a quarry in Cornwall is dumped in this park slightly as an artwork, slightly as a climbing. Nobody knows what it is. So I followed this rock and went across London till I came to the next chunk of rock and discovered actually there is a chain of rocks that will take you all the way back to the Geological Museum in South Kensington, where in a glass case is a meteorite. And I thought, now things begin to make sense, because even the curbstones themselves have a particular kind of granite. And when you start looking at London just as a series of geological episodes, it begins to give you a narrative again. So I think we're moving into the era of psychogeology now.
But in the whole kind of project, the psychogeographical project...
Is there a project?
No, you're right. No,
I think this psychogeographical project is a radio programme, and the very process whereby you introduce it to a larger audience is its own destruction.
That's only Radio 3 on a Sunday night.
No, I'm not talking about your particular
one. Really,
I mean, this is only part of an enormous
wave
of stuff. I mean, if I looked at my emails, there are 10,000 that are from people who are engaging in some aspect of this now.
Yeah.
And also the numerous conferences all over the place, endlessly going on.
I had one last question for Stuart Home. Could you nail down the difference between a psychogeographic derive and going for a walk?
I don't think there is a difference.
No.
It's just in your head.
Yeah.
And there's no difference.
Walking with Attitude was presented by Ian Marchant and produced in Bristol by Jolyon Jenkins. It was first broadcast last year.
On Radio 3, Bank Holiday Monday at the BBC Proms. At 1 o'clock, Christina Schaefer performs Schoenberg's Pierrot Lunaire.
Pierrot, here to the rest, here.
At 3, a journey to the far corners of our musical world with the gospel vocal group Blind Boys of Alabama.
Amazing grace.
And at 8 o'clock, Prom's favourite John Wilson recreates the Broadway sound with the help of his hand-picked high-octane orchestra. A packed Bank Holiday Monday at the BBC Proms. Hear it all live on BBC Radio 3 from 1 o'clock.
And a quick reminder that we're off to the opera at the Proms tomorrow evening when Edward Gardner and his English National Opera forces bring their much-acclaimed performance of Benjamin Britten's Peter Grimes to the Royal Albert Hall. That's at 7 o'clock tomorrow evening. This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. Now, at 10:45, the essay, and in the third of our Interrail postcards, Charlotte Mendelssohn recalls her train journey across Europe with a group of teenaged friends and laments her own inability to allow travel really to broaden the mind.
Octopuses drying on the Peloponnesian washing line, the sun setting behind Notre Dame, the merry cries of street traders in Naples and Marseille. Travel is a wonderful thing. It broadens the mind. It opens the heart. But for that, you don't have to go to Chile or Zanzibar. Europe has all the glamour and drama a traveller needs. At least, that's what we thought, those of us who grew up in the 80s, who, after A-levels and UCA forms, decided to celebrate our coming of age abroad, but not too abroad. Raves, whatever those might be, on Goan beaches were not for us. We were sensitive, protected, pretentious. We wanted culture. We would interrail. It was 1990. The Berlin Wall had tumbled. Hitherto grey, uninviting lands were full of beer, graffiti and skateboarders, and to be young and in possession of Let's Go Europe was very heaven. But I was not young, chronologically perhaps, but not in spirit, nor in wardrobe. And so it was that when four Oxford school friends and I boarded the ferry at Dover to begin our very own grand tour, it was the beginning of an experience quite unlike what the imaginative inventors of the Interrail Pass had in mind. Children, gather round. Cyberspace did not exist 20 years ago. Electricity, barely. You went into something called a travel agent in the olden days and bought a ticket by guttering candlelight with saved-up £5 notes. That bit was easy, if financially frightening. More difficult, in our primitive age, was the planning. Look on a globe. I expect we did. If you were planning a great continental adventure, where would your eye fall? Paris? Of course, the most obvious city on earth. Barcelona, where the children drink coffee and dance flamenco till dawn and the men all look like Almodovar heroes? Yes, please. Budapest, Prague, where ice cream was rumoured to be cheaper than our wildest dreams. 10 pence, maybe even 5. Definitely. How could you not? And let us not forget Amsterdam, where the drug-happy populace, peddling about on those lovely bicycles, are wholesome yet sexually relaxed. Wasn't that every adolescent's dream? It certainly was ours. We were from Oxford. We appreciated bicycles. Yet we did forget Amsterdam. Indeed, we failed to visit almost every metropolis of note. I suspect, with the enormous wisdom of perspective, that we thought we were being clever. We believed ourselves to be, well, not cool, obviously, we weren't completely deluded, but as interestingly ironic, faintly subversive. Wasn't going to Paris a journey we might one day do with our families in the school holidays? Such predictability was behind us now. The future was, shyly, ours, and contained all the things we had been legally permitted to do for some time. Jobs, fun, alcohol, freedom, even sexual intercourse. We would do something different. And so it was that our European debut, the first night of our exciting international holiday, was spent in Brussels. I know. But before envy overwhelms you, let me comfort you with this. Our experience of the Low Countries did not begin happily. Because while we could conjugate ferro, ferre, tuli, latum, and titrate potassium permanganate, we did not yet know a basic rule of budget foreign travel, that the areas around train stations and innocence do not mix. We were not reckless. We wore money belts and sturdy second-hand rucksacks with new padlocks. We had carefully read the personal safety sections in our travel guide. We were, in fact, as far from reckless as non-Mennonites can be. Yet we had somehow failed to notice that the very reasonable hostel we had booked for our first night, we had pre-booked all our nights in a range of languages, was in the middle of the red light district. Did our guidebook warn us? If it did, we probably assumed that red lights indicated a fair bit of traffic, like Cornmarket or even the Magdalen roundabout. It did not. It must have taken some time for our error to be noticed. I remember that we walked, in our white Reeboks or our unflattering summer slip-ons, for what seemed like miles. Or was that because my rucksack was laden with Swiss penknives, horrible peg-leg trousers, spare and spare-spare glasses, emergency phone numbers for every nation, and fat paperbacks, not, sadly, Jackie Collins, but Barnaby Rudge, Philip Larkin's bonkbuster Jill, and that well-known beach read The Brothers Karamazov. And water bottles. It was, as we kept reminding each other, very important to keep hydrated, even in Belgium, after dark. On and on we trekked, probably a little disappointed to discover that Europe did not immediately feature handsome boy men bearing flowers and thoughts of marriage. The streets became ever more seedy. Were we, whisper it, lost? And the signs that this was uncharted ground were increasing. Might sex mean, you know, sex, in Walloon? Girls, massage, where were we? Then we came to the sight I will never forget. A woman, topless at the very least, I couldn't look, sitting on a stool behind a plate glass window, to be bought, like a cake. Was this some sort of show? A prostitute? There were others. Speechless, traumatised, we turned away. But at least Brussels was culturally interesting. Fun, sort of, but culture was the thing. We had an extremely small budget for each day, once necessities like phone calls and entrance tickets were paid for, and we spent almost all of it not on amusing fridge magnets or vodka, but on postcards from museums and churches in extraordinary quantities, to be kept forever, a neurotically exhaustive visual diary. For at our next stop, Cologne, followed by Munich and Berlin, the postcard bulk buying continued. More gloomy Gothic religious art, more peculiar paintings by Otto Dix and Toulouse-Lautrec. It felt vaguely risque and modern buying the Expressionists, with their cabaret girls and androgyny. But when I look at them now, I think, you tragic idiot, you were only 80 years behind the times. Because that was, I now realise, the defining aspect of our Interrail adventure. It was five stays square in Europe. We were entirely clueless, yet we felt mildly daring just to be there. Poor, sheltered, priggish fools. Every single photograph I have is taken in daylight, outside an indistinguishable monument, and we might as well have been on an elderly nun's day trip for all the naughtiness we display. While others, I have subsequently discovered, were snogging their way around the Greek islands, or seducing ski instructors, or, obviously, having jobs, a life, we were obediently following our self-imposed cultural programme, very modest breakfast, two galleries, cheap but wholesome lunch, further galleries and or museums, filling dinner, bed. Every single night. Peer as you might at the photos, you will see no alcohol, no fags, not even a Coke. Or a boy. God forbid. We knew about getting off with boys, of course we did. But that was all. Despite our completely unrealistic dreams, even expectations of romance, meeting a boy spontaneously, talking to one, was out of the question. Anything could happen. Fortunately, nothing did. Highlights of our German travels included Cologne Cathedral, very black, the blue-tiled entrance gates to Ishtar and the Pergamon Museum, highly professional buskers playing dire straits nightly to crowds of teenagers on the cobbles, including, shamefully, us, red-painted performance artists. What were they doing? Was this art? The debate raged far into the early evening. And, which we found very cheering, the willingness of passers-by on Munich subway platforms to offer us unsolicited advice. Two of us were still feeling racially wobbly about the train tracks and loudspeakers of Berlin stations, and found this particularly moving. The brotherhood of man, cultural cross-fertilisation. Ever since then I have remembered fondly the extreme friendliness of the Bavarian people, until it was recently pointed out to me that five giggling and lost English schoolgirls, however unflatteringly dressed, were perhaps quite an obvious focus for about half of the populace. We didn't notice. It was hardly surprising. Think about what one might find on the iPhone and Gmail of today's travelling teenagers. Could any contemporary of Lady Gaga be as naive as we were then? Not that we were Luddites. One of us had a camera, and, in a daringly low-culture move, I had brought my Sony Walkman. Not for train journeys, which were either for quiet reading or discussion. Not, sadly, either intellectual or moral discussion, but variations on all we knew, each other. Which nationality might each of us marry? Which fruit did we most resemble? Which film star should we end up with? I got Paul Newman, because he would say, "Stop worrying and get into bed." They knew me so well. But at night, in bed, I would listen to my cassette tapes, Mary Coughlan and Ella Fitzgerald singing about the great love I feared I might never have, Vittoria, Palestrina and Telemann, just because they were recherché, and, in a rare demonstration of stylishness, Charlie Mingus, whom I love to this day. Still, it was hardly cool, was it? I may know the entire Cole Porter songbook and have a fondness for early choral music, but the hits of 1991, it is fair to say, passed me by. In only one respect was I ahead of the times. Then, as now, I had a problem. It was never physically possible to carry as many holiday books as I needed, preferably one a day, with spares. And so I nurtured a fantasy, a portable electronic device, much like my Texas Instruments Little Professor Maths game, on which all the books of the world could be stored. How would these books magically jump onto the device? Electrically? Really? It was completely mad, I can see that now. So, relying instead on my paperback of Buddenbrooks for kicks, we went on to Italy. Thanks to the films of Merchant Ivory and Shakespeare, in that order, we knew all about the cradle of antiquity. It was simply a question of how much of it we could cover in the time. Rome? Too daunting. Milan? Insufficiently highbrow. No, we based ourselves in Verona, for the opera. Vicenza, empty in the sun, Padua, where the Giotto frescoes were shut, and then, for the self-improving finale, on to the Swiss mountains where, in the only genuinely dangerous moment of our holiday, we accompanied a friend's mother and father on a mountain ramble. This involved crossing sheer slopes of what may have been scree, and staggering, almost weeping with heat and fear, up rocky crags, to higher than Edelweiss could grow, or chamois gamble, higher than sense itself. I have photographs of Coleridgean precipices, a bright blue sky, and, because one of the adults was taking pictures, shots of the five of us together, the only ones of our trip. Four are wearing white or floral sleeveless tops, shorts, little skirts, no cleavage, untroubled by fashion, sensible hair clips, but they look good. And then there is one girl with huge, miserably hot hair, red cheeks, a vast, self-hating unisex t-shirt, baggy American tourist shorts. She is always at the back, the last to cross the ravine. In one of them, my favourite, we are all resting on the grass, the others picturesquely on their backs. Only I am face down, slumped at the bottom. I look dead, a beached whale in a wig. I now suspect that each of us thought we were hideous, although none was, except me. Or was I? Under the clothes and hair, it's hard to see. And that is the secret truth of my interrail experience. I was not there. What I have described is not a small selection of my reminiscences. It is all I remember. How is this possible? Months of saved-up pocket money, a world of Da Vinci's and Rembrandts, 4 weeks' worth of foreign cafes and pensiones and secrets shared, all gone? Did we go anywhere else? I'd forgotten that we were in Berlin after the wall fell. It was only with the greatest intellectual effort that I remembered the smallest proof. Street sellers flogging chunks of concrete with suspiciously bright graffiti, which we were far too sensible to buy. And it turns out we visited Venice. Who could forget their first sight of the jewel of the Adriatic? Me, apparently. When I went there in my early 30s, I had no recollection whatsoever of having been before, but I was. I have found the evidence, a photograph of me pretending to be a pigeon in St. Mark's Square. It is only by looking at the photographs that I can explain this cataclysmic loss of memory. In every one, I am hiding behind the others, tugging my top down, making comic faces in an agony of self-consciousness. That is what I remember of my month of adventures. Not the shock of the new, or the joy of culture, but feeling huge, and hot, and ashamed. I could have been to the moon and back, if it had been within the interrail zone, and I'd still remember almost nothing, because I was an adolescent, awash with solipsism and despair, too lost inside my teenaged brain to see the canals in front of me or the domes above. I don't envy myself the freedom or the time to travel. I look at the girl in the photographs, having the holiday of her life, and think, hold on, only a few more years until adulthood. It will be worth it. Hold on.
That was Charlotte Mendelssohn with her Interrail postcard. Tomorrow's writer is David Almond, who wonders how his journey from Newcastle to Corfu, not with an Interrail pass, but by hitchhiking, may have helped shape his writing career.
Original British drama on BBC Two. A tale of love and repression in Edwardian England.
I know what it is that makes a man want to go away with a woman he likes, but that desire must be resisted.
Adapted for television by Tom Stoppard and starring Benedict Cumberbatch and Rebecca Hall.
You're such a paragon of honourable behaviour, Christopher. You're the cruelest man I know.
Bound by convention to duty and unhappiness.
I stand for monogamy. Monogamy and chastity.
Parade's End begins tomorrow night at 9 on BBC Two.
Now on BBC Radio 3, we visit the Edinburgh Festival for the last of this week's live Late Junction programmes. From the Blue Tent at the BBC's own venue at the Edinburgh Festival Fringe, here's Verity Sharp.
Yes, welcome to the Blue Tent at the BBC's Fringe venue, where once again we have packed the stage full of the world's finest musicians for you tonight. Camille O'Sullivan is going to join us just as soon as she's finished performing at the Lyceum Theatre just down the road. But all set and ready to go here, we do have members of Scotland's leading new music group, the Hebrides Ensemble. They're going to be playing music for us by John Adams, Charles Ives, and also James McMillan. And then in the far corner, with guitar in hand, or soon we'll have, we have Scotland's leading master songsmith, Dick Gochan. And then lining the front of the stage, seated on carpets and cushions, we have the six members of the Alim Gazimov Ensemble. Now, Alim Gazimov is a singer from Azerbaijan, and he's done incredible work, not only to bring a very old and deeply spiritual Azerbaijani music called Mugam to the world's attention, but he's also modernized it in a way which has brought in younger singers and players. So amongst his ensemble here, we have musicians who've studied and are studying still with him, and also sitting right alongside him is his daughter, Fargana. And we're going to hear more about this music in a little while, but first, true to Late Junction form, we thought we'd begin by hearing tonight all of tonight's musicians playing back-to-back, and we're going to start with a piece called Sevgilim, as performed by the Alim Gazimov Ensemble.
Çekilin, kuçelerin,
Ay ay özü bir ayağına gelmez. Yara geçmiş yine kalın üçün nebati O belalı aşık indi